Living in a scientific age, we need citizens who know enough about science to make intelligent decisions about what they do. We've used science to prolong life, to increase security and happiness. But it can also be used for destruction. Are we going to use it constructively? It'll be up to you, and you too.
I don't know if you heard in the news about the lady that beat up her husband, beat her husband to death, actually, with his guitar collection.
I did not. That sounds horrifying.
It was really serious. She went to trial. The judge asked, you know, first offender? She's like, no, started with a Gibson and then a Fender.
I was playing this before because I was very frazzled on the way over here because my plans for the day had changed a little bit.
Oh,
and
no.
So I had to have my little meltdown. And so to center myself, nothing makes me laugh harder than the goats yelling like humans. So I was playing that before. And
I think they're, it's because goats genuinely sound like humans imitating goats.
Right. And there's some... I could watch this and laugh all day long. And now I have to wait.
Right.
Because I just find it so fun. And I think it's because, yeah, you're right. It sounds like people imitating goats at the same time.
Right.
Oh, man, that makes me laugh. Well... Welcome to another episode of the Mark and Toddcast. I am one of your hosts, Todd Workoven, and with me, as always, is Mark Middleton. How are you, Mark?
I'm really well. It's been a good week.
It has. It's been an interesting week. I've been sick, so I'm still a little bit stuffed up, but my brain just didn't slow down, so I feel like it's like a dog that's been left inside too long that needs to like go
Stir
outside
crazy.
And just
yeah.
run around, and that's what my brain feels like. So I'm a little all over the place today, but I wanted to start out before we get into our news. There's a couple things, and they fall into the category of the least relatable things I can think of.
Okay.
And one of them is an update on the ticket I got in Milwaukee, which I think
yes.
I talked about in the show.
I read your rant.
Yeah, so I won't go into it here too much. But yeah, so because I was a day late in scraping together the $80 to pay them, so they doubled the ticket. And the only way, and since I don't have checks, like paper checks, which is the only thing, she said, well, you could send a money order. And I was like, well, how much is that? I don't know. The most unhelpful lady in the world at the front desk of the city of Milwaukee. So yes, I have another month to scrape together that money, but I'm so irritated. And there's my neighbor, actually, Dana, she sent me this little clip of an upcoming news story, I think on KGW this week, Thursday, about ridiculous parking infractions and parking tickets going on in Portland right now. And so I have a feeling that the state is really under budget with something and is really just hammering down on that.
It's crazy. I mean, you were there to buy things from the city, like from
right.
vendors in
yeah.
the city, and they are actively
keeping me away forever.
Right.
But I mean, and so I think what I'm going to do is write
post in the Chamber of Commerce website.
I posted on their Facebook page and then was met with the well, our admins will approve this. And no, shockingly, it was never approved.
What?
But I think I might write a letter to the city, but then also include the two businesses that I was there to visit.
Yeah.
And say, I just wanted you to be aware that nobody is going to come to your town because it's just a bunch of narcs collecting things that have nothing to do with their city. I mean, it wasn't even a parking infraction in their city.
Right. Right.
So anyway, but the other least relatable thing, and I texted you and Nick about this early, and this is a documentary recommendation. And it is such a niche topic. I can't believe it actually exist, like way more niche than the documentary on the Helvetica font,
right,
which I thought was like probably the, but I mean, everyone else I've talked to loves it. So I know there's at least an audience for this.
The hipsters.
But there's a documentary that I've probably seen more than any other movie in my life. And it came out when I was 16 or 17, and it was Madonna's Truth or Dare.
Oh, yeah.
Now, just prior to coming out, that movie coming out, she was on an episode of Saturday Night Live. She did a Wayne's World skit, and they shot it like in black and white, and she had her platinum blonde hair, and it was just like, and I was in, I think, eighth grade. I'm like, oh, I get it. I love Madonna. Look at her. And so, and that came out right after that. And I mean, I wasn't a sheltered child, but it was like, it was this whole weird look into like fame, which I was kind of intrigued with, and documentaries, which I'd always loved, and this singer, like this most famous person in the world, and a provocative person too, that like she was all of my, like, I'm not going to be the anti-religious person because she'll push the button, like all of that intrigue. Right. And so that movie came out, and it was a documentary about her Blonde Ambition tour going around the world and all, blah, blah, blah. But for that tour, she had like 7 or 8 backup dancers for that tour, and they feature a lot in that Truth or Dare documentary. So now, kind of like the documentary series from England called Seven Up, where they visit when the children were 7, and then every 7 years, 14 up, 21 up, 28 up, they visit them every 7 years. So kind of like this documentary just came out called Strike a Pose, of course, and it catches up with all of those dancers was in that movie. Because when that movie came out, I mean, that was in 1990, and that was like the AIDS crisis was full blown in the gay community. And so there was a lot of that featured in the movie, and all of those messages that were. And so it follows them 25 years later where they are now. And I've always just kind of wondered in that same 7-Up way, like whatever happens to people who are like one day auxiliary, living on the street, like performing as a, you know, as a busking for money dancing. And then for the next year, you're with the most famous person on the planet, and all of that, you going in front of 70,000 people who are holding up signs with your name on it because they saw you in this or whatever. And then the next year you're living on the street again because you're not that person people came to see, you know, all of that stuff is just so intriguing to me. So anyway, it's on Netflix right now. I knew it was coming out last year. And it's finally on Netflix, so it's called Strike a Pose. For the 0 people that interests, that specific niche market, a follow-up of background characters to a documentary no one ever saw. So,
I remember watching that movie with my best friend and his girlfriend. I was home on leave from the Navy.
Okay.
And this was what they wanted to watch. And there were they were scandalized a little bit, buddies from church, and
I used to make people watch it too. I'm like, hey, let's sit down and watch this. And it was the brand new movie theater by my house, which it used to be like this cornfield, and all of a sudden they built this brand new movie theater that had like all these cool neon lights, and it was dark, and just like, so that whole experience of like going to that theater. And so anyway, do check it out for the no one that wants that. But so let's move into some news here.
Nice.
That's kind of short, I guess, but whatever.
That's good.
So you want to start us out here?
Sure. So this is in the category of things that didn't need to be added technology to. because I feel like everybody's trying to make the iPhone connected toothbrush and
this is that article we had a couple of weeks ago about the diaper that will tell you if it's wet via your cell phone.
Exactly. So this is called the Travelmate, a fully autonomous suitcase and robot. So the Travelmate is the first true robot companion and fully autonomous suitcase. It works seamlessly in crowds and doesn't require extra peripherals. Travelmate can go can move both vertically and horizontally when in autonomous mode. So you can take it with you when you're going to the airport.
It's a self-rolling suitcase, not a suitcase that turns into a robot.
Correct. Okay. It is.
I was very excited about the prospect that my, but then I couldn't figure out how I would keep stuff in it because every time it, like your clothes would just fly everywhere.
No.
That's not a bad idea. You have a little Bluetooth thing in your pocket and it just follows that signal.
It just follows
you. Like a puppy.
Right. But it's
Well,
You're taking their side. That's what I'm most shocked about right now. Because if you watch the video, it's literally just in the same place that your hand would be carrying the thing.
But my hands have all this ice cream in it,
right? But there's no other signals of it, and I just feel like somebody's going to trip over it,
right?
And you're like, oh, that's my robotic suitcase is going to be the
because I can't move my arm like this.
It's so hard.
It's heavy.
Okay.
Yes, I would be furious if you came home with one of those, and I would ceaselessly make fun of you forever.
And so they're taking pre-orders on Indiegogo right now. They've reached like 17,000% of their goal.
Of course. Anyway.
Drivers gear up for the world's first nanocar race. And so these chemists, six teams of chemists from three continents are preparing for a unique race on a polished gold track in the south of France this month. So it's no luxurious supercar event. Competitors will be racing single molecules in 36 hours. They aim to move them a distance of 100 nanometers, about 1/1000th the width of a human hair, on a laboratory track held in a vacuum, chilled to a few degrees above zero.
Oh my gosh.
Above absolute zero. And so they have established these rules, and they're creating these custom molecules that interact with the field energy produced by the... basically the ion gun from an electron microscope. And so you're not allowed to touch the vehicle with the electron microscope beam, but you can interact with particles around it, which then can interact with that beam. And so they're using this beam to over 36 hours to move it
100 nanometers. Wow. I wonder if that's
science.
A spectator sport.
So Oreos are coming out with cookies and cream Oreos.
I saw the picture that you posted, and I want nothing more than to be eating those right now.
But cookies and cream flavor is Oreos. Like, where cookies and cream came from.
But now I can have that flavor without chewing. The chewing was in the way because I had to mix the cookie and the cream together myself. How funny that
and
didn't
so these
even
are
occur to
cookies
me.
Cookies and cream Oreo
flavored
sandwiches.
Oreos.
And so inside the Oreo,
the cream is cookies and cream flavored. That's like, yo, dog, I heard you like Oreos in your Oreos. So I made these
Oreos with Oreos.
That was my exhibit impression.
Yeah. Okay. Google's new chip is a stepping stone in quantum computing supremacy. So I thought we'd just spend a couple minutes talking about quantum computing and what, why that's a thing and what generally that is.
And we have special guest Justin Trudeau, Canadian Prime Minister, is here to talk about quantum computing.
That was a great
interview.
That
was pretty fantastic.
Fantastic. So, so by the end of the year, the team at Google says that they will build a device that achieves quantum computing supremacy, meaning it can perform a particular calculation that's beyond the reach of any conventional computer. And the proof will come in a form of a drag race between Google's chip and one of the world's largest supercomputers. So they've got a chip that will be doing computation matchup against a mega supercomputer that has many, 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 many chips in it.
Right,
and
okay.
Processing in parallel. So the big picture is electronics, computing happens at ultimately the level of standard physics, which is ones and zeros. And so we use transistors and microscopic transistors to say when voltage is applied here, that makes this a 1. When voltage is applied here, that voltage is a 0. And if we can use zeros and ones, we can do addition. If we can do addition, then we can do multiplication. And if we can do multiplication, we can do anything that computers do now, right? And, you know, get, you know, graphics processors and, you know, all the things that computers do, ultimately get down to the transistor level. We are approaching a limit in the physical size that transistors can be because they're getting down to the size of atoms. And so we can't get any smaller.
That does not compute.
That does not compute.
And it's so, neither a 1 nor a 0 in my brain.
And so we will be approaching a, you know, we are approaching, and we're not there yet, but we are approaching a physical limitation of computing power.
Oh, interesting.
And so there's...
For this type of computing.
For this type of computing. And so theorized in the early 80s, and work has been done extensively by people like Ray Kurzweil and some others, of quantum physicists are using the behaviors of quantum mechanics to do computing instead of the traditional Newtonian physics of this is electricity, this is a 0, and this is a 1. It's much more based on the probability of this electron being in this location at this rate. And it gets really abstract really fast, and I am definitely not the person to talk to about it. Google, there's going to be a lot more attention paid to it this year as Google is coming out with a quantum computing chip. And so they have things like qubits instead of bits and bytes. There's a qubit, and that basically has the probability or the computing power of multiple bits at the same time simultaneously. And depending on when it's observed, you get the value or not. It's very theoretical and mind bending. And Google is
leading the way.
Leading the way.
Wow. So can quantum Windows be both crashed and not crashed at the same time?
Exactly.
Zing! Take that, Bill Gates.
And then you've got some.
I do. Stuff. Yes, I have a couple stories here. The first one involves Steve Ballmer, who you may know from.
Developers.
I still hear this all the time. Anyway, this story involves Steve Ballmer. Steve Ballmer plans to pursue what may be one of the most ambitious private projects undertaken to answer a question that has long vexed the public: figure out what the government really does with the money. On Tuesday, he plans to make, or he made public, a database and a report that he and a small army of economists, professors, and other professionals have been assembling called USA Facts. The database may be the first nonpartisan effort to create a fully integrated look at revenue and spending across federal, state, and local governments. So it'll answer questions like how many police officers are employed in the various parts of the county, what are the crime rates, how much revenue is brought from parking tickets, city of Milwaukee, and the cost to collect them, to pay that one person to walk around taking pictures of people's license plate to run it through Trek machine. Want to know the percentage of Americans who suffer from depression and how much the government spends on it? So all of that sort of data is going to be available in some sort of a way. Quote, I would like the citizens to be able to use this to form intelligent decisions, Ballmer said, having no idea how this country and its people think or work. People ought to base their opinions on a common set of data that are believable, he says. So how are they? I'll take a quick look on how they're going to do it. So he has an unlimited budget, and he's hired a team in Seattle and the University of Pennsylvania. But he's only spent $10 million on it so far. So he said, let's say it costs $3, $4, $5 million a year, he said, to do this data collecting and data mining. He said, I'm happy to fund it. He doesn't want anyone from the government, no outside providers, so that there's no interaction with what the information says. He says, for example, do you know that it's not legal to know how many firearms are in this country? The government is not allowed to collect that number. There's data for the firearms manufacturing, how many were manufactured, the license and inspections with other data, but the NRA has lobbied in such a way that the government cannot report this data. So that's one of the things that he's hoping to open up. So
to me,
I'm hoping like there's more people, more wealthy people like this to say, look, $3 million a year for that.
Right.
So that all of this, how we're spending stuff and how to make that better and how we can make wiser decisions. I'm hoping more people, more private people do that. So we don't have to do that with government money because then it will never get done.
Right.
So,
I feel like no matter what is presented, if there's data that's shown to you that contradicts what you feel,
oh, yeah,
you'll just say, oh, that's a liberal scam, or that's a right. conservative scam.
You are fake news.
Yeah. Yeah. You're, and on both sides of the aisle,
oh,
not,
yeah, yeah.
not just one side or the other. Like if conservatives show liberals, look, we've reduced size of government and we're doing this to put the whatever.
Right.
It would just be met with
scorn
and hate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Moving on from things that are only relatable to me to a story that is only relatable to Mark. I asked him before, I'm like, should I keep the story? He's like, I think I will probably be the only person interested in it. So MIT is selling 8 million valuable IPv4 address. Is that how you say that? IPv4? How would you say that?
It's IP addresses. Okay, there's V4 and V6.
Okay. So an increasingly scarce stash it held since the birth of the internet. The details of the sale hasn't been public, but they've said 14 million of these addresses have not been used, and we have concluded that at least 8 million are excess and can be sold without impacting our current and future needs. MIT is among a number of institutions that have been sitting on large swaths of 4 and 6 addresses that are otherwise only available now on secondary market. So and it says the university's decision to sell sparked diverse discussions on such forums as Reddit.
Yeah.
So when it talks about addresses, is it talking about the numbers? Like the numbers. Know stamps.com or
nope.
whatever, the name?
The numbers, not the name. So the IP addresses are 4 numbers between 0 and 255. And so there's 0.0.0.0 is the first one, and 255.255.255 is the last one.
Okay.
And there's only a limited number of those, but every single thing that is on the internet gets an IP address. And so every server gets an IP address, including like not just a website. If a website has multiple servers, each of those, if they are accessed,
how
publicly,
have we not filled this up yet?
They're becoming scarce.
They're becoming limited. But I mean, they have 8 million of them,
right?
Lying
and they
around,
get cycled. So. They get recycled. So
so it says the institute holds a block of 20 nonillion addresses, which is 20 × 10^30 power.
Wow.
20 nonillion addresses. And they weigh 4 ergs each.
4 ergs each. And you can buy them with a Bitcoin.
Moving on. Snapchat reportedly spends $7.7 million to buy a patent
user.
Filing from Yo App. They have bought it from a patent from Mobile, who is known for launching a message app that only allows users to say, yo. The technology in question is virtual overlays, including text and graphics that can affix to smartphone photos and videos based on the user's location. People at a basketball game could place the team's logo on their photos, while folks strolling through Hollywood can get the option of putting a Dolby Theater banner on their images. Snap allows companies to sponsor such overlays, calling them geofilter ads.
But what are they buying from YoApp?
Apparently, it's just the
ability to say
it's
yo?
A technology. It's one of the geolocation technologies that it's kind of one of the background things. So I don't think they're using anything about the yo format. They're just using what was under the hood. Snap spends an estimated $9.5 million for 245 IBM patents and applications and a small batch from Yahoo. Surprisingly, Mobley, who is behind the Yo app, has struggled to get usage for its social media app. The startup has occupied its blah, blah, blah. It looks like Yo app used to be part of Snapchat, then went on its own and now is floundering and will probably go back under the umbrella. But so Snapchat still is kind of like an Instagram thing, which is still kind of like all of those other things like Twitter that literally there is no way to monetize it, right?
So
I mean, I guess Twitter has ads now.
Twitter has ads. The thing with a social network is if you don't see a revenue stream, then the people are the revenue stream.
Right.
And so Facebook purchased Instagram because they had a user base. And so they were buying the users and they bought those users for $1 billion. And, you know, and the technology of adding the photos, but they had the technology of adding photos. That wasn't the issue. Right. They wanted that community. And so if you can find a community of people, then
who only type yo on the things that they send back and forth to each other, that's where the money is.
Stupid.
Anyway, so that's all for news this week. Let's go to Brian, the Unipiper kid, who will talk to us about something or other. I don't know, because we haven't recorded that yet. So we'll go to that. When we come back, I wanted to talk a little bit about Hedy Lamarr and a technology she developed that we still use today. So we'll be back in just a second. Hello, is this Brian the Unipiper?
Yes, it is, Todd.
I waited long enough to not get cut off at the beginning.
I'm so proud of you, Todd.
It's amazing. Well, let's see if I can try and ruin your show another way.
So what's going on with you? Actually, before you start, I wanted to talk about a couple of weeks ago when it happened, and I kept forgetting you are now verified with the blue check mark as the Unipiper, are you not?
I am on both Facebook and Twitter.
So what is, I've always wondered what the criteria or the process was for getting something like that.
It's kind of interesting. I think they had so many requests. It used to just be something that was done by Facebook or by Twitter. And you just had to wait around and it would happen if it was going to happen. But I guess they were inundated with so many people reaching out with questions and stuff that they have now instituted a process. There's an application process. Facebook and Twitter are each a little bit different. Facebook, it's a pretty simple form you fill out, but Twitter, you have to submit some documentation showing that you are who you say you are, and you have to submit websites that reference you to show that you are of some notability.
So that's more like the Wikipedia, where you have to have several references in national publications or whatever before they kind of allow you, quote unquote, to have your own page.
Yeah, yeah. And as far as I can tell, Instagram is still, you just have to wait for it to happen. And this was probably a good time for me to throw out there that you guys are being broadcast right now on Instagram Live.
Oh my goodness.
Nice.
That's right.
What a time to be alive.
So hopefully there'll be some people out there who don't know what the Mark and Todd cast is yet.
I have a perfect... Hold on. One moment, please. I have a perfect for those new people. This is exactly what the Mark and Todd cast is like.
That's the whole thing.
So welcome to that.
It doesn't get better than that.
It does not. Does the Facebook, don't mean to go back to it, but you said the Facebook one was different. Now, is there still obviously there must be a criteria that you have to fulfill before they give you one, or is it just paperwork?
You send them a utility bill that goes to one Unipiper drive.
Yeah, it's basically like submit your page, and I ended up having to send them a picture of my driver's license.
Wow, that's so interesting. Oh, that's cool though. So yes, yeah. the blue check is finally there. Awesome. So what's going on around Portland this week?
What's going on in Portland? My favorite Portland celebrity is finally getting the recognition he deserves. I don't know if you guys heard who has been named the Grand Marshal of the 2017 Rose Festival Starlight Parade.
Who is that?
That would be our very own John Elvis Schroeder.
Nice.
Wow, very cool.
Yes, that is very, very cool. Of course, he follows last year. We had the PDX Carpet was the Grand Marshal of the Starlight Parade. So I think they've turned themselves around and made the right decision this year. It's going to be a lot of fun. The Unipiper is going to be in the Starlight Parade too this year. It'll be my first time participating. And that's the parade at nighttime.
Oh, wow.
And everything has to be glowing. Obviously, I'll have my fire, but I'll need some ideas for some other glowing costumes. So if any of your listeners or any of my Facebook Live followers have any suggestions of what you want to see the Unipiper do for the Portland Starlight Parade this year, please let me know.
Night. You should do like somehow the Portlandia statue. Like you should just be holding spears and like huck the shirtless and then hucking them into the audience or whatever that big huge statue is leaning over all the time.
Or the
and then charge people $100 every time they
or the fire outfit at the beginning of the Hunger Games when she comes out and all ablaze on a chariot.
You could totally have one of those changing costumes or whatever they make of like the fabric that you unpin it or whatever and twirl and it's like a whole different outfit.
Quick
all of
change
a sudden.
Outfits.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, nice.
I ran into Elvis myself on Friday. I was out downtown unipiping and he came running up to me with a big grin on his face and he's like, guess what? And I was like, what, Elvis? He was like, I'm going to be the Grand Marshal of the 2017 Starlight Parade. And he was just so excited.
That's
so
awesome.
That's cool.
Truly could not have happened to a better person.
So does he still, excuse my ignorance, does he still perform somehow or is he just the guy, you know what I mean? No,
he is still into his performance 110%. He's out most Saturdays at the Saturday Market. He still performs on stage at Dante's on occasion. And he was doing some karaoke at Dante's this past week. And they surprised him with the announcement. And they came out with a giant voodoo donut cake on stage.
That's funny.
Nice. I remember probably 2004 or so at Voodoo Donuts, which was the old window right next to the theater. It wasn't where right around the corner where it is now. And just Elvis in there singing holiday tunes. It was like, you know, November or something or December or something. And he's just in there in his guitar. And the whole foyer, the whole room is about as big as a walk-in closet, and right. He's there in the corner playing Christmas tunes, and the line is kind of snaking around him.
That's funny.
That was fantastic.
Nice.
Old Portland.
Old Portland. Yes.
In fact, Voodoo Donuts this past year released an Elvis special vinyl holiday album.
Oh, nice.
Awesome.
Yeah, which is really cool, and they were interviewing one of the co-founders, Trace Shannon, about this announcement. And I think he summed it up really well. He said, I think Elvis totally and completely sums up all of what is quirky, scary, and fun about Portland, Oregon. He is a perfect conduit to the new Portland from the old Portland.
Nice.
Oh, that's great. Really yeah. great.
Perfect. So that's cool.
Other news in Portland this week, coming up as a prelude to the Rose Festival, which kicks off in June. But this coming Saturday, there's actually a giant parade called the Avenue of Roses Parade that goes down 82nd. It's being put on by the Avenue of Roses Business Association to try and get people to come out and experience all that 82nd has to offer.
I experienced all that 82nd had to offer today on the way here, and it was pouring down rain and potholes and meth users, and I experienced it all.
Washing the meth away.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, so... This was an interesting news item. I came across a story, and it had a picture of the famous Portland sign, not the one on the Burnside Bridge, but the one in front of the Schnitz downtown.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The headline was, "Another Portland Dead Memory, Portland Sign Coming Down." And did you see this article, too?
No.
I clicked on it and read it, and it is coming down for 2 months while it is being repaired.
Oh,
and
brother.
It's like...
Come on, people. Sensationalism, shock jockery.
Clickbait hacked.
Clickbait. Well, that's good. That's not going away.
But in actual awesome news, Ground Control Expansion is now open. Did you guys already cover this in your show?
No, we haven't.
Oh, good. Mark, have you been there yet?
I haven't been to the expansion yet. I think it was last week that it opened, right?
Yeah, last week. And it's their ultimate plan is to connect it to their old location via a tunnel.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So when this whole renovation process is done, it will be twice the size with twice as many games. The old portion is now closed for the next couple months while they get that renovated. But the new portion is all open. I've seen some photos from it. They have a giant computer screen. Old vector style maps and graphics. It's made to look up like the set of war games.
I saw a picture of that. It looked amazing. It's like the entire wall.
I can't wait to go and check that out.
So they are in the same location then, correct? Just a different building at that location?
Yeah, it's on the same block, but around the corner. There's like another business that's kind of between the two locations. So it'll be funny to see if how long they last and if they ever get bought out until they have a mega Ground Control.
Yeah. Oh, that's great, though.
Yep. A couple of events going on this week. There is on Tuesday, I'm going to be going to the Hollywood Theater as part of their Grindhouse Film Festival series. They are showing a 1985 film called Creepers, which is an Italian-produced horror film by one of my favorite horror directors, Dario Argento. It stars Jennifer Connelly, and she has the power to control insects. And this movie is famous for a scene in which a chimpanzee runs around with a razor blade and slashes people.
Nice.
Why do I know that director's name? What else did he do?
Oh my gosh, he's done so many. He was like the horror version of all of the spaghetti westerns. And he did, I think probably his most famous film was Suspiria. Huh.
I feel like maybe I've read it a bunch of times, but didn't know what to associate him with, so.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. So that's Tuesday?
That's Tuesday.
Okay.
And then the very next day, on Wednesday, there's something being put on by the Willamette Radio Workshop, which is a group that is does produced and live radio dramas in the style of the Golden Age of radio.
Yeah, that's cool.
They're doing an adaptation of a book called City of Weird.
Yes. Yeah.
It's an adaptation of 5 short stories from the City of Weird book that was published last year. And so they're going to do a drama version of 5 stories covering everything from how do you say gentrification in Martian to what does existential angst look like for killer slime molds from outer space and their nurturing spore-filled mothership when they touch down in Portland.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. This is going on in downtown Vancouver on Wednesday. But then it's also they're going to do an encore show at the McMinnville UFO Festival this year. That's coming up in May.
Nice.
So I might just have to check out that book, City of Weird.
Yeah.
I never
heard that. Interesting.
Yeah.
Nice.
And that's literally all I had. If you had 30 more seconds of tape.
Well, it was worth it to hang out in awkward silence for a while.
Yep.
If people wanted to find out more about you, Brian, actually, speaking of, before we get to that plug, I saw on Facebook, if you're a Facebook friend of the Unipiper or you follow the Unipiper, I got a little notification that says you can follow where I'm going right now. Click on this and to do the find the Unipiper. So that was fun to click on that and see you riding around town this week.
Yeah, I did that on Friday, and I had more than one person actually use it to track me down.
Oh, wow.
It was very fulfilling. It felt good knowing that my efforts on making this silly little GPS tracking app were not all wasted.
Oh, totally. No, that's pretty great. So if people wanted to find out more about you, where else could they go?
Yep. They can see that front and center on my website at unipiper.com, where you can stay up to date on all the latest Unipiper news and events. And for any Instagram live viewers that are managed to hang around and they still want to hear more of the Mark and Toddcast, where might they find more Mark and Toddcast?
Oh, well, they can go to markandtoddcast.com. And for both of us, for all of us, facebook.com/either Unipiper or Mark and Toddcast.
Cool.
Awesome. Well, it was great talking to you. We will talk to you again next week.
All right. See you guys.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye.
That? Oh, the name of the robot suitcase. I'm surprisingly in favor of that. I guess just in theory. And right. Also because I thought it turned into an actual robot. All right. So today I wanted to talk about someone who I've heard brought up every now and then. It was a name I recognized, but whose story I hadn't really looked into. And I think coming up, there's been a kind of a flurry of articles about her, and there's going to be, I think, an HBO documentary or movie based on her. I'm not sure which one that I think Susan Sarandon is doing. But it's an actress from the 30s and 40s named Hedy Lamarr. And she is one of those, if you haven't seen her, I think I'll probably use an image in her post, but she's kind of that golden era of Hollywood, bombshell with the black and white. She had very dark hair. She kind of looked, you know, a little bit like Rita Hayworth and a little bit like Betty Davis or Joan Crawford, that type of thing. Just incredibly, incredibly beautiful. But in after her movie career, and we'll talk about all this here in a little second, I just want to give you an overview. After her career in movies, she helped develop a technology for wireless communication transmissions that we're still using today in Bluetooth and our Wi-Fi systems. So she was born in Vienna, Austria in 1914. She was born in, her real name is Hedwig, which she eventually changed to Hedy Lamarr. And she was discovered kind of walking around Berlin when she was 16 or 17, and she started training in theater. She was obviously very, very beautiful. And so she trained a little bit in Berlin, then went back to be an actress on the stage in her home of Vienna for a while. She landed her first movie at the age of 18, and it was kind of one of the erotic thrillers of the 30s or so. But she was kind of tricked by a scurrilous director, and apparently, and I have not seen this footage, I don't know if it's still in the movie. The movie's called like Exotic or something like that.
Ecstasy.
Yeah, there you go. I say hoping that you're looking that up on your computer and you didn't just like know in the back of your head. Oh no, that was Ecstasy. But they used like a bunch of telephoto lenses to get shots of her topless that they inserted in the movies. And obviously back then that was a huge controversy, although in Europe it was less and still a little less scandalous. But because she was so good in the role and the movie was being good, she won a couple awards for that and was considered a pretty respectable actress. But it really turned her off, obviously, to wanting to make movies because she was just so exploited by that whole telephoto lens and the director. And while she's becoming this famous, beautiful movie star, there was a man named Friedrich Mandl, and he was the third richest man in Austria, and he was a widely known weapons and arms dealer. And he owned the house that Sound of Music was filmed in.
Okay.
So when you think of that house, this is the guy who owned it, and he became obsessed with... her name was not Hedy Lamarr yet because she was still in Europe with Hedwig Keisler, and just wooed her. And eventually she was kind of won over by both his personality and the fact that he was the third richest person in all of Austria, and married him in 1933. She was 18 and I think he was in his 30s at that point. So they were married for a while. He was super possessive of her, really one of those, wouldn't let her leave, didn't really want her to be in the movies because she was that sex symbol, and you know, he wanted to keep her. And So because he was this famous arms dealer and we're gearing up to the beginning of World War II, this is the mid-30s now in Berlin and in Austria. So this guy, Friedrich Mandl, is meeting with Hitler and Mussolini in his house, and they're having all these backroom discussions about technology and bombs and war machinery, and the guy would drag Hedy Lamarr, before she was Hedy Lamarr, to all these discussions and meetings because he didn't want her to go anywhere, and she was smart enough that she just started to learn all of that. She eventually got out of that marriage in 1939 or 37, excuse me, and went to Paris, where Louis B. Mayer, who was one of the founders of MGM and probably the most powerful producers in Hollywood at that time. MGM would have just, I think, been gearing up to do The Wizard of Oz, which I think is in 1939. So he discovers her now in Paris after she fled that marriage, takes her to Hollywood and dubs her the world's most beautiful woman. And for the next 10 years or so, from 1940 to 1949, she was in 18 movies, really well regarded, not the huge breakout star that you'd know, like a Rita Hayworth or a Betty Davis. But she was in the most popular movie of 1949, which was Samson and Delilah, playing Delilah. So she was this kind of a sensation. So I would guess kind of like maybe a Selma Hayek, where you know her for being beautiful, right, and she is talented, but you can't really like name a Selma Hayek movie outside of Frida, where she has the terrible unibrow. She plays Frida Kahlo, the artist.
Right.
So she has a pretty good career for about 10 years or so. Then it starts cooling off. She's not offered as many parts. And so she kind of is getting bored of that. And so because of her boredom and her history of not really liking to sit still, she becomes an inventor. And she's mostly self-taught, and she has all this information that she gathered, you know, from all of those meetings during the 30s. She has Hollywood connections. So Howard Hughes, she becomes a confidant of Howard Hughes and redesigns a wing for him, because Howard Hughes is like, I don't know, this plane is going too slow. And she looks at it and buys a book on birds and fish, and she's like, well, this wing is the wrong shape, let's do it this way, and like that totally works. So that kind of
nice,
hands-on, let's go fix this problem practically type of person. During this time, the war is happening, because now we're this kind of pops back to in the mid-40s, so we're in like 1942 right now. And she learned that the radio controlled torpedoes that our submarines and our ships were firing were really easy to intercept and really easy to jam that signal. And so she contacted a composer friend of hers, a piano player, and they developed this technology called frequency hopping. And it's based on a player piano thing. So the idea of frequency hopping, which is kind of the thing that she helped develop, she wasn't the sole inventor of it, but she helps develop it. And it's a type of communication, like I said, we still use in our Bluetooth technology and our Wi-Fi technology. But it's basically sending a message over a different series of frequencies. So you hop back and forth in a random pattern that only the sender and receiver knows. And they based it on the 88 keys of the piano. And if you think of the player piano thing, which is just a long strip of paper with the little holes in it to tell which keys to go down, if you have a random pattern of those 88 notes playing one part of the message at a time, you can still eventually decode that, but not fast enough to, you know, intercept the torpedo or something like that. So they weren't able to get a patent for it because the military at that time didn't want outside people becoming involved for whatever reason.
Okay.
So even though she got the patent, it wasn't really deployed during the war.
Okay.
And so kind of sat on a shelf until about 1962, when we were gearing up for the Cuban Missile Crisis. And apparently we're updating our Navy and stuff like that. So the Navy starts to implement a version of her design, now is showing up in the Navy ships during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So the technical thing is called... Oh, there's a big long name here. Spread spectrum communications technology. And the big nerdy definition is a method of transmitting radio signals by rapidly switching carrier among many frequencies using a pseudo-random sequence known only to the transmitter and receiver. So there's a couple different benefits to it and stuff. I'm not going to get too much into that. But she develops all that. It finally is kind of integrated into the Navy and other communication systems that come from that, like our wireless and our Bluetooth. Meanwhile, and it was funny when I was looking this up, I'd kind of known about all of this before sitting down late last night to do this after after watching 5 hours of Little League Baseball during the day with some of the kids that I took care of. And it kind of doesn't have a super happy ending, although kind of in theory it does, like the, well, at least he was appreciated after his time.
Okay.
So we're getting to the 70s. Her career has kind of begun to dry up a little bit. In 1966, she was arrested for shoplifting. She was also arrested in 1991 for shoplifting 20 to... So sad. This is what I was reading last night. I was like, for shoplifting $21 worth of eye drops and laxatives. But she's not getting work. She is getting more and more reclusive. In the 70s, she sued Warner Brothers and Mel Brooks for $10 million for the name Hedley Lamarr, which is a character Mel Brooks wrote for Blazing Saddles. So that is Harvey Korman's character in Blazing Saddles. It's called Hedley Lamarr.
Okay.
And so she sued, I think there was an out of court settlement that happened with that. In 1996, do you remember Corel Draw, which very well may still be around, but the Corel Draw box that was released in 1996 had a picture of her that someone had illustrated using Corel Draw, and that like won the contest or whatever for, that's going to be our packaging. And they didn't ask her to use her likeness, but since it wasn't, it was like an illustration. It was like one of those things. Well, it was her. So they sued her for that. Yeah. And I totally recognize that box now that they said that. That's Hedley Lamarr on that. So there's another out of court settlement for that one. According to her son, during the 80s or 90s, she began, or it must have been the 70s, because she had a lot of really, really, really bad plastic surgery. She got her breast done, her cheeks raised, her lips bigger, and much, much, much more, said her son. And all of that backfired and made her look apparently like some crazy monster. And so she always only would talk to people on the phone. Throughout all this, she was married 6 times, her last time to one of her divorce lawyers, which I thought was funny, but for the last 35 years of her life, she was single. She ended up passing away in the year 2000. But out of all of this, she was kind of, I think because she wasn't at least a household name in the way that you might recognize the name and realize it's one of those black and white stars. But right. I don't think anyone was like, oh, like you said, yeah, she was in that movie. Or I remember from 1949, Samson and Delilah. She kind of fell away a little bit, but now that there's the big push for women in science and all of these kind of stories that are told afterwards, she's kind of getting her due a lot more. Like I said, there's a movie coming out with Susan Sarandon, I think producing it. There's a lot of great articles that are coming out now that kind of tell her story, which even beforehand, like attending meetings with Hitler and Mussolini because of her possessive, like all of that is, and I think she said at one point that someone wrote an autobiography about her without her input. It was one of those, it was somehow put out under her name and she eventually sued for it, but done by someone else that was like fairly scandalous and fairly like you couldn't, like the person that she really was, like this inventor person, like wasn't. So apparently she sued for that and she did a couple long interviews, but I don't know that she ever sat down to write her own autobiography because she said, I don't think it would be believable just because of all these random things that have happened and the success to which she was able to succeed in all of those disparate categories. So I found that interesting. I always like to find little stories of people who either you forget or had an interesting trajectory that you weren't aware. And I always like to see people like that are really good at two different completely opposite things, that they're able to like go back and forth and to use all of the their whole brain instead of just the one piece that was good at one thing. So
yeah, that was really fantastic.
That was the end of Hedley Lamarr's story.
Hedley?
Hedy Lamarr. Oh, and here we're gonna have the goat that spits in people's faces. Boy, is there anything else?
All right.
What else that we want to talk about?
The April the giraffe was
April
born.
April the giraffe, yes, finally had her little calf.
We watched that live.
And I saw that the giraffe mom, as they called her, who was the lady who was pregnant right at the end of January, whenever they started live streaming April and wore the giraffe mask or whatever, she went out to meet April and the baby. Have they named the, or is there
a
contest to name the baby probably? So good old April the giraffe. So yeah, other than boycotting the city of Milwaukee, except for those two stores that I really like. And that's the shame, because it's not like a Michaels, like I was saying, where there's like five others to choose from. It's a locally owned comic store and a really cool antique store that has a bunch of neat stuff.
Right.
And I'm afraid someone pointed out that I'm going to go there to pay my ticket, and they're just going to look at my, as I pull into the parking lot, they're going to be there writing me another ticket because my registration still isn't paid on account I'm trying to pay the ticket for expired registration.
So like
#  relatable things, strike a pose documentary on Netflix now before it's too late.
All right.
So yeah, you can visit markandtoddcast.com for all of our other episodes, all 82. I think this is episode 83. So do that. Get a hold of us if you have topic suggestions that you'd like us to hear or to talk about. They don't have to be long or complex, or they could be something complex that you want kind of boiled down like we did with CRISPR. That would be awesome. Just let us know that you're listening. Go to iTunes and give us a rating. There is still, according to iTunes, not enough ratings yet and I think you need 6. So come on, people.
Come on. Rate us.
Come on. You could also visit PortlandAtTheMovies.com. For our movie podcast, Fatal Revenge is our newest episode of that. And other than that, what should we? Oh, let me find the Steve Ballmer Developers remix that I remember and love so well. And we will take you out with that. We will see you guys next time.
It's awesome.
So ridiculous.